So if we start at the beginning, you know, how did you get involved with the peace movement?
It was just around. I was living in Lancaster, and the women that I knew, university there. I was doing a teacher training course at the time. My daughter was about two, and how? I've no idea how. There were women's discos. There was a women's aid place. There was a refuge in Lancaster. I know somehow I got to know these women that were involved in all those things, and in singing and music and all sorts of things. And my friend Sue used to hire a minibus and drive down to Greenham, and it seemed to end up being my job to keep her awake by talking to her. And she always drove with bare feet, I remember, for miles. And it was just fun, you know, it was the thing, it was the latest thing that was on.
So did you start by going down on the odd occasion?
Yeah. For big demos.
Right.
Yeah, that's how it started.
Right.
And then I left Lancaster and went to live in this women's commune up in Scotland near Lauriston. And those women were much more, I would think, really more radical than I was. And they all got arrested, put in prison. And then we had endless streams of women coming up to stay with us to recover from whatever they'd been through.
Right.
So I think it became a bit of a centre, really, probably.
In Glasgow?
No, this was in south west Scotland, near Lauriston.
Ah, right, sorry.
Cucubershire.
Right.
Lauriston Hall, it's a community.
Right.
And we were just young and idealistic, that's what I think now. Very idealistic. And challenging everything, really.
And so, did you go down for the big Embrace the Base? What was that like?
It was great. Lots of singing, big crowds of women. It's great fun. I enjoyed it. It's good.
And where did you stay? Did you
Greengate mostly?
Right. And was Green? What was the sort of because all of the gates had their own character.
They did,
didn't they?
The Greengate was the more welcoming to ordinary women, let's put it like that, who weren't really radicalised or anything. I think that it was more, we were there to welcome women, really. That's what it felt like, to make them feel okay about, you know, not to, whereas some of the others were very harsh, and if you didn't look right, you didn't get in, sort of thing,
And did you have experience of that when you first arrived? Because I guess you must have made your way to...
And then there was all the class stuff as well, and I'm very middle class, so that was a bit of a issue in some places. As soon as I open my mouth, people go, oh, she's one of them, you know.
So what was the issue with class then?
Well, because we were challenging everything, I think middle class people like me had been... I'd been taught how to speak, if you like, or to speak up. I had elocution lessons at boarding school, you know, all that stuff. So I knew how to address people in a way, to some extent. Not that I did much of it, because I'm quite shy, really. But the working class women didn't like it. They didn't like to be just in the same way that men think that everyone ought to listen to them. They felt that middle-class women, because they spoke out or could speak out, only spoke about one lot of people. It wasn't about everybody, and that it wasn't unequal, it wasn't fair, it wasn't... I didn't speak for them, basically. I didn't, it's true. I can't deny that. I only spoke for myself. But... it got to a point where I was afraid to open my mouth, I'll tell you that much. You know, you actually became so aware of all those issues, you thought, oh my God, keeping your mouth shut roles, you know. It was heavy, you know. It was it was making you think about all the power issues everywhere in your life and making you think about it, whether you bloody wanted to or not, actually. You had to, and you had to have an opinion, and you had to have thought about it. The worst thing you could say was, oh, I haven't thought about that, and be naive and ignorant. That was the worst you could be. So,
was that did you have sort of big collective meetings where you would all get together? Because it doesn't sound like Greengate might have been so judgmental in terms of
it wasn't
opinion.
It was much more vanilla-y, I suppose you might say. Much more probably more middle class as well. My impression was that the Blue Gate was much more working class, harder, women who were prepared to do more violent things as well. And that and go to prison. I mean, you did have to think about, am I, and I wasn't prepared to go to prison because I had Hannah and I was the only one responsible for her, and I was not going to put her in that position. So although I wasn't completely clear about that in my own head, I didn't ever go to prison. You know what I mean? I didn't do things that would have got me into prison, whereas other women deliberately did, you know.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, there's nothing. I mean, the collective nature of it presumably meant that people could choose whether they did or they didn't.
Definitely.
And how did you feel the collective worked? I mean, was it an effective, non-hierarchical? I mean, you know, you've already kind of suggested that there was a hierarchy in some respects, politically or into class terms, if nothing else.
I think with most people there was an awareness of trying to avoid being hierarchical. So middle-class women like me deliberately didn't take over, let's say. However, when it came to doing things like giving paper reports or talking to the police or dealing with authority in one way or another, those women who were middle class were much actually better at it in terms of being on the same, knowing how to be polite was helpful, you know what I mean? Whereas if you were just screaming, shouting, you bastards, da-da-da-da-da, you know, it wasn't going to work, you know what I mean? So in some situations, the more middle class people inevitably did the talking, I would say, the negotiating.
Yeah, I do get the impression that women were very... because of the non-violent direct action, that violence in language as well wasn't really the way that, you know, it seemed cleverer than that.
Yes, exactly.
And humour seemed to be used quite a lot as well, to almost, you know, in sometimes in a gentle way and sometimes possibly not, to mock the authorities and, you know, prick their bubble sort of thing.
Yes, definitely. There was a lot of creative things that people did, individuals did, that were really clever, clever and really circuitous, or sort of, you know, like a clowning can be very revolutionary, actually, but it does it in a way that you don't even realise they're doing it. Very clever, very not direct. So there was a lot of stuff that happened like that was brilliant, you know, really good.
What sort of stuff? Can you remember anything?
I remember there was a woman artist there who did some amazing work. What's her name? Blimey. Is it Jay? I think she went up and lived in the Hebrides at one point. She did some really clever art stuff using rubbish, in effect, stuff that was just around. Mm. She would make things, like make scarecrow-like wild figures, and just great, you know, really imaginative. And she definitely worked on her, she just had a particular quirky way of seeing things, and would get on with doing it her own, very quietly, would just do something, but it would be just spot on, you know, just, yeah, great.
And were there any sort of artist protest type things that you can remember?
No.
No.
No, not
really.
I mean,
really. I think the sanitary towel on the
fence.
On the fence is
yes.
I mean, that for me is, you know, that's a, quite an artistic protest.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Sorry. Go on.
Sort of shocking, but in a. Not in a harsh way, I suppose you could say, but in clever, undermining, devious ways.
Yeah, undermining is a good word, I think, for what I've seen. You know, it just.
And in terms of the contact between the guards and the police on the gates as well, we talked to them, we laughed with them, we tried to get them to see our points of view, you know, not be our enemies, not be. And some of them it worked with, some of them, you know. And in the end, I think that is what worked, you know, it did work, it did stop, that whole base closed down. And I think it was all those much softer, direct communication things that worked best, really.
So how did they respond to you, the police and the soldiers?
Well, very differently. Some of them were, no, we're not even going to talk to you, don't even exist. Others were chatty and humorous and fine. Just depended, you know. Mm. But it did depend on partly on how we were with them as well. Mm. It's an exchange, you know.
And are there any conversations you can particularly remember with them?
No.
No, that's all right.
I can't.
Yeah, it's and again, some of the women have told me that they've, you know, had conversations with them where the soldiers have said, "Oh yeah, I've got a sister."
On yes. The other side of the fence. Exactly. You've got to know them because they were there for a while, you know, and they were as bored as anybody standing around on this gate, you know, really freezing cold, middle of winter. They loved it when we were all singing and dancing and.
So were the songs a big part of Greenham?
Oh, big. Mm. Yeah, yeah. Well, for me anyway, because I'm a bit of a singer, so I loved it, yeah.
And were the songs just sung, was it a sort of round the campfire thing, or was it just all the time?
Lots round the campfires, but when we did the circling of the bass things, songs would come round. I mean, this, you know, it's a few miles long, would come round, different songs, lots of different songs. I circle around the, what's that one? Wearing my long tail feathers as I fly. That one, you know that one?
Yeah.
As there were lots of songs that went around that people knew and that just sort of got taken up and moved round, you know, went round.
What difference do you think singing made? What was the...
Oh, I just think it brings people together. I think it's a wonderful thing. Enjoyable, uniting thing, really.
And do you think that feeling of being united was important to the protest, or just to the women generally?
Yeah. Yeah, it was for me, definitely.
And was it...
And empowering, because we were all... Because I suppose... Yeah, one of my best friends, Aggie, had a car. She was a mechanic. And it was all the sorts of women who could do things like that who became really important, because she could mend cars, and that was really needed. We didn't want to go to a garage where there was a man who was going to do it. We wanted Aggie to do it, you know. So she'd be, you know, Aggie, come over to this gate, you know, do you want to get going? Oh, and the batteries run out, and da 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 da, you know. She was quite a heroine, really. And she ended up going... all around Canada doing talks about Greenham as well.
Wow.
Nearly knackered her completely, but Yeah, she became quite a heroine.
What an opportunity, though.
Pardon?
What an opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, she was paid for. Everything paid for and looked after as she went back all around Canada, giving talks and slideshows and everything.
So did you ever get involved with the money at the camp or anything like that?
No.
No. And how were the sort of meetings where everybody came together, the sort of more collective meetings, how were they sort of run in terms of the non-hierarchical collective manner? How did women get to?
I don't remember them. I'm not really somebody who enjoys meetings much, to be honest. I probably did avoided them like the plague.
Mm.
My impression was that they were very mixed and that there were big arguments that went on as well as, you know, it was a time of questioning everything, even the language that you used was liable to be jumped on. You know, you had to be really careful what you said for fear of being bloody patriarchal. You had to mind your P's and Q's, definitely. So I think I tended to avoid all those sorts of situations, really. And what I enjoyed doing was the singing and the dancing and the more sociable stuff, I suppose, really.
And so when you started going, you started visiting when Hannah was two, and but did you then go and live at Greenham at some point?
No, I never actually lived there. But some of the women that I lived with in Scotland did.
Right.
Yeah.
So from two till, when she was two till four, you toed and froed. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's quite a long time of, particularly if you've moved to Scotland, that must have been quite a commitment.
I mean, I moved all the time. I was one of these people who just, I think when I was young, I just went where the energy was, to be honest.
Mm.
You know, I just thought, oh yeah, this is good fun, you know, let's go there, you know.
Mm.
This is where, I was right hippie before that. You know what I mean? I feel like I was just born, 1951, at a time when, after the wars, I suppose, people wanted something better.
Mm.
And all that optimism that we were born into, somehow, I just rode that wave, I think, with, you know, gurus and meditation and going to India, all that sort of stuff.
Mm.
I just did it all. Just did it all and I loved it.
That's a really interesting connection, I think, the sort of post-war, because I think, you know, women had that sudden liberation, didn't they?
Exactly.
In terms of jobs and what they were allowed to do, and then Liz just went straight
go
back
and
on
be
it.
Mothers.
Mm.
My mother hated it.
Mm.
She'd been a nurse in the war and loved it and hated being a suburban housewife, and I think her frustration and her sense of women can be more than what she was brought up to be, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
We inherited that, you know, we picked up on that. And free education, I mean, all the things we had free. Free education, went to university, didn't pay a penny.
Mm.
You know,
mm.
It was brilliant. It was a brilliant time to be young and you could just get a job if you wanted.
Mm.
You know, there were hundreds of jobs.
Mm.
You know, it just it was easy.
Mm.
It's so much easier than it is now.
Mm.
So much more difficult for young people now.
Mm.
Much, much more difficult. I had a very supportive father who was, you know, certainly much more enlightened than most men probably. And a Quaker and all sorts of good things, you know what I mean? I had a lot of good upbringing, really, that encouraged me to be very confident and to believe that I had a right to do what the hell I wanted when I did.
So was religion sort of visible at the camp?
Oh, it was interesting. A lot of the Quaker pacifists groups came to the camp, and you could tell them they were mostly older women for a start, and they were quietly very strong, you know, and you had to admire their quiet determination, you know, they were great. I really enjoyed meeting some of them, and some very intelligent, highly educated, and articulate women. Yeah.
And so how old were you when you went there? So you would have been
27, 28.
And in the conversation with Kate, you said that you also realised that a lot of the women who had gone to Greenland were quite damaged. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Well, after I left the community I lived in Scotland and went to live further south, I did a therapy training, and which was a bodywork therapy training, and became a therapist. And with Aggie, actually, did lots of workshops all over the country. And the style that we were trained in was very much about expressing yourself in one way or another. And it actually involved a lot of screaming, shouting, bashing cushions, letting it all out, basically, which for a lot of women, they had never been given permission to do that. And so it all came out. And, you know, now I think it wasn't very... perhaps not wise in some ways to get people to do that sort of thing on a weekend and then send them home to cope with the results. Do you know what I mean? It was a bit irresponsible, perhaps, arguably. But it did sort of, it did allow a lot of expression of things that hadn't been expressed before, let's put it like that. And a lot of abuse stuff came up. Hell of a lot, hell of a lot. It was like a sort of a hidden thing that actually was coming out at that time, you know, beginning to come out, as it has done more and more, I suppose, ever since. And a lot of the women, certainly that I met in Todmorden, I lived in Todmorden in Lancashire for a while, which is quite a lesbian stronghold now anyway, they hated men because of the way that they'd been treated by their fathers, uncles or whatever. And didn't know that. A lot of people didn't realise that that was what was behind it. And only through doing therapy did they discover that they'd been abused or whatever, you know. So I mean, I don't know. I don't hate men. I never did hate men, let's put it. So I'm different like that. I had a very good father. And I did find it all a bit... Why do they hate men so much? Why are they so... All men are absolutely... You know, that's what they used to say, you know, really. All men are absolutely... Wait a minute. You know, so-and-so isn't, or so-and-so isn't, you know, what? And although I was really into creating a society which worked without men in lots of ways, I didn't hate them like that. Really, I didn't. So I think I was coming from a different place.
And were these women who came up for these workshops from Greenham for the weekend, or some of them?
No, all over the country. Right. This was later.
Right.
That would be more in the 1980s, I guess.
Right.
Yeah. I've done the training. Yeah.
And do you think that was an attitude that was held in some of the camps at Greenham?
Yeah.
For the same reasons, you think, with the same kind of... the same route in terms of abuse, or
well, there was all the political stuff as well, of course. I mean, that, you know, patriarchy basically, but also I think it was the first, maybe for a lot of people, it was the first time they had been in only women situations, and just living without men makes you realise a lot of things, you know. It just does. Well, what can't we do, what can we do? Oh, we can do this, we can do that, we can do everything, you know. I mean, it was great. It was very, very empowering, very empowering, and very supportive. I met Monica Hsu when I was on a demo going across Salisbury Plain, and we became good friends. And she was an amazing woman. I really liked her. A lot of people found her really difficult, but I think perhaps because I was tall and loud and confident like she was, you know, we just sort of, yeah, you're all right, you know, it's all right, we can handle each other. And I remember there was a circle, I think at the Green Gate probably, where, I don't know, how did it happen? I don't know whether I was already starting to do therapy in effect or counselling, maybe it was the co-counselling thing, but we were all getting into our feelings about men, let's put it like that, and she just went for it, Monica did. And I held her and grounded her. And I suppose that's partly where I discovered I could do that, you know what I mean? I could actually be a rock.
Mm.
So even someone like Monica. Yeah. I think my personality is such that I tend to be more of a support person than a rebel rouser. Let's put it like that. That's my character.
Mm.
So that was the role that I found myself in more.
Yeah. So, in terms of how you lived when you went down there, would you stay in somebody's bender, or did you have you just have
them? We'll make a bender, yeah.
Right. Yeah. And how did you learn how to do that?
You looked at others and worked it out, yeah. I suppose. Yeah. But I mean, there were all sorts of benders. There were all sorts of amazing structures.
Mm.
Some more successful than others.
Sure.
Oh dear. I mean, I've camped all my life, so I've always been an outdoorsy sort of person, so I've always had those skills, really. Yeah.
And so you were obviously there sort of towards the, like, 84, was it, when the eviction, they started doing the evictions? And what was that like? That must have been quite frightening. I guess.
Quite
frightening in some respects, because the bailiffs were fairly...
I don't think I was frightened by anything. When I was young, I rode motorbikes, I went travelling, I did anything I wanted, and nothing really fazed me. I wasn't the sort of person to be frightened by anything, really.
Mm.
I'm a bit more cautious nowadays, I would tell you, but in those days I was up for anything, really. Just, yeah, come on, let's do it, yeah, come on.
What happened during the evictions? What did you get, like, any advance notice?
Sometimes there would be screaming, wah! You know, various things. You'd all wake up and grab your stuff and run, or stay there and get caught, or do whatever you did, you know.
Mm. And if you got caught, what would that mean?
If you resisted arrest, which some people, women did, they would haul you off and take you to the cells and book you, and then the whole court process thing went on. I don't know how, but I managed not to get caught somehow, one way or another.
Mm.
I didn't actually get caught.
Mm. And did you ever go on to the base?
Yeah, oh yeah, did all sorts of stuff, cutting the fence. All that sort of business.
Mm. And those things sound like the sort of things that you could get arrested for.
Yes. But, I mean, to get arrested, you had to stand your ground and be arrested. If you hightailed it off, they wouldn't catch you.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, I mean, that's what I did, basically. I made sure I didn't get arrested.
Mm. And have you still got your bolt cutters?
No. Bolt cutters just came and went through one's hands. I didn't own any.
Some women have still got theirs.
Are they?
Yeah, they have.
Painted green and purple.
Who knows? I haven't seen them, but yeah, I'm sure. So how, when your daughter tells you things about how scared she was and her getting arrested and so on, how do you feel about
guilty,
that?
Guilty, thoroughly guilty. I don't think I should have exposed her to that. I should have looked after her better. I certainly should have recognised that she's a Cancerian and I'm an Aries. I mean, she's a quiet, creative... She's not like me, you know what I mean? I should have recognised that and given her more security than I did, I think.
Yeah.
I think it was hard for her being my daughter. Mm. I do think that now, but... I mean, she's okay, you know. She's now a very successful theatre designer in London. She's very creative. She earns lots of money. She's doing brilliantly. Mm. Yeah. So, you know, I don't think it was the end of the world.
No.
I think she must have had a strong enough character to be able to manage it. When we were at Green and we all dyed our hair pink and blue at one point, so she of course wanted her hair dyed pink and blue, so I took her to her working class Middlesbrough grandmother's house to be looked after, who just freaked. I cannot have my granddaughter out in the street with pink hair, it's not going to happen. Put a hat on her, on Hannah's head, and took her down to the hairdressers and got her to dye it brown again. So Hannah had everything. She had a really lovely, she was a wonderful grandmother, much more supportive than my parents were. She was the first grandchild of a Catholic family, so she was, you know, she had a big place in the family. And their daughter, and she loved going to stay with them, so Hannah learned. She learned. You now have blue hair up in Scotland, but down in Middlesbrough, you do not have blue hair. Mm. It's not going to happen. Mm. And I think that's good for kids. Yeah. They know. They learn. Mm. They learn there's different rules in different places. Mm. Very different rules.
Yeah, because there were women who were quite scared that they were going to, that being at Greenham was going to create a situation where they might have the children taken away from them.
Absolutely. Mm. Hannah's father went to Australia, luckily. Mm. When we split up, he was very, very upset. It was dreadful. But I was adamant I was going to become a lesbian and I was not having anything more to do with men. That was it. Sorry, mate. Bye-bye. And we tried to share her, but he couldn't hack it. He couldn't hack it at all. So he went off to Australia and I was really glad. That was the best thing, as far as I was concerned, he could have done. Because he could have taken me to court in those days and got her off me.
Mm. Mm.
Yeah.
And did that happen to anybody that you were aware of?
No, not that but I'd heard about it. I had heard that could happen. Because in those days, I think the courts thought lesbians were not fit mothers, fundamentally.
Mm.
And, yeah.
Mm.
I did hear about it happening. I didn't know anyone personally.
Mm.
But, yes, I was glad that he went to Australia, basically.
Mm. And where is he? Is he still there now?
Yes. Yeah, we're back in touch. Mm. Things are fine, and he's back in touch with Hannah, and yeah.
Good. That sounds good. Sounds healthy.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm glad.
Yeah.
I want her to have a relationship with him now. I didn't in those days, but now I do.
Well, I think, you know, that kind of ability to say I'm taking her away is, you know, it's not an equal relationship, whereas hopefully now it is, you know.
Yeah.
So, and she gets to choose as well, doesn't she? She can do what she wants to do. So, do you think, do you see anywhere where the sort of non-violent direct action is used in sort of more recent protests? Have you seen anything you think, oh yeah, we did that at Greenham, we did, you know, any of the sort of Occupy-type protests or anything like that?
I really like that bloke who dug tunnels. What did he call? Swampy or something.
Yeah.
Do you remember him?
Mm, mm.
I loved all that sort of stuff. I thought that was brilliant, you know, the way that they... And some of the... there were some demos in Derbyshire about the quarries, that they were taking all the quarry stone out and, you know, distributing it around the world and decimating the quarries. And there were people living in the woods up near Nine Ladies Stone Circle, up just near here. And I used to go and take them food and stuff at one point. But I mean, basically, I think my whole orientation has changed from being very political when I was in my 20s. Maybe this happens to a lot of people, I don't know. And then settling down, then getting into therapy, then bringing up children, and then becoming an artist. You know, it's like, that's a pattern that probably goes for a lot of people. I had to earn a living somehow, so I became, partly because of that, became a therapist. Now I'm living on a state pension. I haven't got the fucking own money at last, and I can do whatever I want, and I bloody love it. I have no one else to support, and I can live, you know, on my own terms and do what I want. It's fucking great. So I'm just lucky. I'm so lucky that I've got all that, what, reserves of self-reliance that mean I can do that, you know. Shall I show you some of the things I've just made?
Yeah.
Let me show you. I've got pictures on here. It's not going to be good on the recording.
Don't worry about it.
I've just made some shields for a shamanic group locally. I don't want that. You want that. So, press the thing. They're made out of willow frame and then wet strength tissue paper with cellophane and wool and all sorts of things on them.
Oh, I love the seahorses. Do I swipe to get...
You, in the bottom, there are four of them, four directions. There's an air, water, earth and fire one.
Fantastic. That's lovely. The wood at the bottom is gorgeous as well. This bit here.
So they're sort of see-through. They're a bit like stained glass as well. That, you know, you get the sun in the right position, you can hang them up and they see through them.
Fantastic. They're gorgeous. Really lovely.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, they look pretty solid as well, actually.
Pretty. Solid. Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're quite... Well, they wouldn't be good to get them wet, but...
No.
Apart from that, they should stand up.
So is that for something that is happening locally? Is that for a
yeah, festival? Have you heard of Glennie Kindred? She's written various books about trees and Celtic spirituality, I suppose you would call it. And she's got a group called The Elementals, who are all big... They do a lot of eco... protesting. I haven't got what the latest thing they're doing is. They've got a name, but I can't remember what it is now. But I'm... What's the word? I'm much more reclusive than I used to be, let's put it like that. I don't want to be in lots of groups, and I'm much happier being on my own, doing my own thing these days.
Yeah, doing your art and giving it to them. I think, again, I interviewed a couple of women in Glastonbury and one in Weston-super-Mare, and generally they live on their own or they live with another woman, and they are pretty self-sufficient, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, reclusive is a, you know, implicit in that is a judgment, isn't it? And I think, I just think they're happy, you know, with themselves.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is, you know, quite something in this day and age, isn't it? So what would you say would be, if you were talking to women, you know, if you're running a workshop and you're talking to young women now who maybe hadn't even heard of Greenham and the protest, which a lot haven't, what would you say would be the legacy? What is it that you would like to know about them, to know about Greenham what is it that future generations should take?
We did it. We succeeded. That's the best thing about it. We actually got that bloody place closed down. And the strength of Women Together was just mind-blowing. Really different from working or demonstrating with men, where it often gets violent. It's just different. It's very different and very... well, very effective and very quietly powerful, I would say, really.
So what do you think the main differences are? The non-violence is a big one, I
big
think.
Big one, very big one. I mean, I'm quite sure there are some men who would not be violent. I'm not saying that all men are violent at all.
No.
But... just say no. Just say no. I'm not doing that. And having the confidence to stand up and say no. It's very good. It's great. It works if you really mean it. And you say no. I'm not moving. You know what I mean? I just think it's... it works. I think it works fundamentally or something. Because anyone knows if somebody means it or they don't mean it. And if you mean it and you really stand your ground, other people back away, they don't bother, you know.
So, what was the relationship like as far as you were concerned with the local residents?
Mixed. Some people invited us in and gave us food and came with food and were very supportive. Other people were absolutely terrified of us and literally shut their windows and curtains when we came past. Oh my God, it's that lot again. I think a gang of us went up to Callanish Stone Circle in Lewis one time with the kids, several kids. And the people, I mean, Scottish people, they were just so wonderful. It was pissing with rain all the time. We were sort of squatting in an old cottage, you know. And they just said, let us have the kids. The poor bloody kids were getting soaked. And they entertained our children while we did whatever we did around the stone circle. And despite the fact that they took one look at us and probably thought, oh my God, what we got here. They were human and they were kind and I don't know, I think, and the kids felt that and they felt really safe and they just watched telly and got fed meat and God knows what in these people's houses and they loved it, you know.
So, because Greenham particularly I think is quite a Tory kind of area. And although I know that you know there were some really nice people up there, my understanding is that the general population, you know, when you went in for food or to go to the shops or to go to the pub or something, that there was.
It was very tricky going to the pubs. Yeah, I think that was a bit. I don't think I hardly ever went into the pubs around there. I think you would have encountered a lot of antagonism, especially from the men. Because I've just had my knees done and I've been staggering around, unable hardly to walk for about a year. I've had incredible amounts of help from people and I've been so touched by complete strangers. Can I help you? Can I do this? Can I do that? Everywhere I've gone. And I think that when I was young, I put myself outside of society very visibly. In the way that I looked and my attitude to the rest of the normal people, wrote them off. Arrogant, really arrogant. And I really feel differently now. I really feel like actually ordinary people, like those people in Lewis, are just amazing and wonderful and kind. And I wish I hadn't been as arrogant as I was when I was young. Mm. And I feel like I'm just a human being now. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like everybody else. I'm not this bloody world-saving champion or something that I thought I was.
Do you think
it's youth, isn't it? That's just what you young people think they're going to change the world. And we really thought we were going to change the world.
Yeah, and you look at people who are ordinary, in inverted commas, and you think, well, I'm not going to be like that. It's not going to be my life, which is a good thing in some respects, because I don't think otherwise you'd have gone to Greenham.
No,
you know, that's you know, it's important to have those times.
But look at the house I live in now.
Yeah.
Well, normalness couldn't be more normal in the world, really.
Well, but nice and comfortable, yeah. And you know, it's your castle,
yeah.
And people only come in if you want them to, and you know, exactly. I think that's, you know, and what happens in here and what you do in here and how you what spaces you have for what, you know, if your art or whatever is, you know, how you run the inside of your house is completely up to you. So this can be as alternative.
I'll never live communally again as long as I live, I can assure you of that. Never, ever again.
Did that run its course then, eventually?
Oh God, it did it just, whoa. Dreadful, absolutely dreadful. No, and I never want to hardly even go to meetings anymore because I just think it's full of egocentric gits who want to be heard and I can't be doing with it.
Mm.
No. Meetings, communal things. Oh, it's my idea of hell, absolute bloody hell. I'd much rather just go out and do it, whatever it is, and spend hours talking about it.
Mm.
On Aries, you know.
Yeah, I think it's a massive generalism, but I do think that is a factor of age. I mean, you know, some people with age seem to like get more into meetings, but
they love it. They want to talk about it all.
Yeah.
I'm just not like that. It's not in my nature.
No.
I'll do it. I'll do something, fine, but I don't want to talk about it for days on end.
Mm.
I hate it. Absolutely hate it.
So do you think Greenham had an influence on the rest of your life, Greenham specifically?
Oh God, yeah, definitely.
In what ways?
Well, in the fact that I became a lesbian, I became someone who thought, you know, well, I suppose I did always have a sense that I had a right to an opinion.
Mm.
But something about being in a gang as well, it's a bit like when you're a minority group, there's a big sense of belonging and almost like family-like sort of feeling about it all, and I did love that.
Mm.
I did love the fact that we're all doing this together and, wow, you know.
Mm. A sense of belonging.
Good fun, you know, it's good energy.
Mm. So were you not out, or did you not think that you were a lesbian before you went to Greenham?
Well, I don't think I am. I don't think I ever was just a lesbian. I think I'm bisexual. That's probably most people are if they let themselves be.
Mm.
But I mean, I took that on as my identity when... Was it? No, it was before Greenham, actually. Just before Greenham. About feminism and when I was living in Bentham, Mickey.
My sister-in-law lives in
Bentham. It was just the latest thing. That's what I think.
Mm.
Like being a hippie, you know, that's where the energy, that's where good, great things were happening. So I was just drawn to it, you know.
And how important for you was the women-only space at Greenham?
It was great. I liked it. I enjoyed it mostly. It was empowering. It was... We're doing this. It was a sense of us.
Mm.
Yeah, that's what I got out of it.
Mm.
Us, yeah, that us thing.
Mm.
It's a bit of a cop-out, really, I suppose. I mean, I don't, in some ways, I don't think I was terribly responsible. I'm not a deep thinker, you know. I know some people do think about everything they do and really analyse it, and I'm not like that, you know. I just go where I think it's, have a good time, really.
No, I think
that's awful, but it's true.
It doesn't at all. I think people are allowed to have a good time, and I think people had different motivations for going there, but I don't think people would have gone there
if it had been miserable.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So, yeah, and as you say, you know, once you've found your tribe, and you found you were in your camp, you know, then yeah. There was, you know, there's a. I think there's an incredibly supportive and almost sort of self-discovery element to being able to sit and talk to other women. Because where else could you have done that in the 80s? Where else could you do that now? So, yeah, it was an unusual set of circumstances, I think, for women to be able to go and talk about whatever.
I just feel so bloody lucky to have been born when I was, to the parents I was and to everything. I just think that I've had an incredibly rich life, you know. I've travelled all over the world, you know. I've done everything. I've done... It's just brilliant. Mm. What a life.
Mm.
It's great.
Mm. Yeah, no, that's great. It's really good. It's really good. And I think it's good for... I would, you know, would very much like young... women, you know,
to know that's possible.
Yeah.
Don't be satisfied with what's not really, you know, what you're not really enjoying.
Mm.
Go for what you want.
Mm.
Definitely. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think there's definitely a message from Greenham, you know, in terms of history, you know, that sort of social political history, but also just in very human terms from older women to younger women, which just gets lost. And I think, why do you think the suffragettes are, because I know it's the 100 years centenary of some women getting the vote, you know, so the suffragettes, who were a protest group and quite violent, have been, you know, very much celebrated, but Greenham is never mentioned in that.
I think it will be. I think it's too early. I think probably when we died, about 20 years time or something, or I don't know, 40 years time, it will be.
Why do you think they'll have to
That's
wait?
That's just the way history is. Herstory, I should say, probably. I mean, it's just the way... I think it's too close. I don't know, I just think that's how things happen.
Mm.
Somehow. Maybe it's not until you've lost something that you recognise it's gone.
Mm. Mm.
But I mean... It hasn't gone. I mean, my daughter, she wouldn't put up with any shit. Mm. You know what I mean?
Mm.
She wouldn't. I know she wouldn't. Mm. And she'll stand up for herself.
Mm.
And she'll go for what she wants.
Mm.
All that role modelling has been instilled in her and will be instilled in her children. And
Yeah, well, that's...
All the way through.
That's the, you know, that is a great legacy, isn't it, for a mother?
Yeah.
Mm. And definitely. Is she your only child?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. I'm glad I had a child. I nearly didn't. I'm glad I did. Because I think that whole experience has been very grounding for me as well.
Mm.
I had to work. I had to keep a house over our heads, you know, all that stuff.
Mm.
I think I could have gone off with the fairies a bit more than... I did, if I hadn't have had her to keep me grounded and sensible.
Mm.
I just spent 6 months up in Fintorn community in Scotland, and that was quite an experience. And I feel more down to earth than most of the people out there.
Mm. So is that communal living something that you still do from time to time then?
That wasn't really communal living. I had my own house.
Oh,
it's the living with other people I find difficult,
because
I'm quite a sort of organised, I like to know where things are. I like to have my pencils sharpened and not blunt or whatever. You know what I mean? All those practical things. And other people don't, and they drive me up the fucking pole. And break things. The amount broken in Scotland. Kate, every time she was coming on for a period, she just dropped things. There'd be nothing left.
So how were things like periods and, like, I mean, not that it is a medical thing, but how were kind of, you know, illnesses and things like that and periods, just that normal kind of day-to-day life stuff that women have to deal with, how was that managed at Greenham?
Very openly, not hidden, I would say, like that picture of Sally, yeah. Overt. I mean, in a way, that was being a bit revolutionary, we felt, I think. There was a bit of that about it, but I mean, I was lucky. I was very straightforward and had great period pains or anything awful, you know. Other people had, you know, days in bed, you know, in agony. So I was comparatively lucky like that. But I think probably because I'm basically got a strong constitution. I've always been very healthy and able until recently, and that brings with it a certain confidence and a certain set of assumptions. And I think I found weak, moaning, pathetic people difficult. God, he's looking at me. Oh dear, I think I did. And there was a lot of that around as well. Oh, I've got my period, I can't do anything. I don't have a lot of patience for that. Because that's not my experience.
Yeah. Do you think you're a bit more patient with people now, a bit more tolerant?
A bit more. A bit more, but not enough, probably. Probably not enough. I don't know.
But it sounds like you were, you know, as you said with Monica, you know, you could still be a rock for people.
Yeah. Yeah, and the whole community that I was in broke up when I left, actually. You know what I mean? I didn't recognise how much I... was a stabling influence, let's put it like that. I think I must have been more than I realised, much more than I realised. Practical, just sort of down to earth sort of person, you know what I mean? Not. I don't know, I had a very comparatively easy upbringing compared with a lot of people as well. Really.
Yeah, I think those survival, those outdoor, you know, digging the pits and making the benders.
That was easy. That was no problem for me at all. All that stuff.
And I think that's you know, 80 or 90% of everybody's life, isn't it? That sort of you know, getting food and all that sort of thing. So those things are important, aren't they?
Yeah, and I killed the chickens and skin the rabbits, and, you know, other people wouldn't even touch them, you know. I mean, I would just do that stuff. My mother was a nurse, my father was a doctor, so I mean, it didn't faze me, you know what I mean. But some people,
I thought, because weren't a lot of the camps vegetarian or vegan?
Oh yeah, all that as well.
So obviously yours wasn't.
What were we? We tried various things at different times, but the truth of the matter was I would take Hannah out for bacon sandwiches every so often because I got fed up with it. So I was not a very correct vegan or vegetarian, really. I was a bit of a rebel. I was always a bit of a rebel. Whatever the rules were, I was going to rebel against them wherever I was living.
Mm.
And if people were too fucking, you know, high and mighty about how perfect their diet was, it just pissed me off.
Mm.
Made me want to go and have a bacon sandwich.
Mm. So where did the rabbits and the chickens come from?
Well, the rabbits were always getting caught by the cats. And the chickens, we had chickens, and you had to kill the cockerels. I mean, that, you know, that is what happens when you have chickens that lay eggs that have, you know, you have end up with too many cockerels. So you have, you know, somebody's got to bloody do it.
Mm.
Muggins is the one who always seemed to end up having to do it.
Mm. Well, I dare say everybody managed to eat it.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Once it'd been plucked and dealt with, they could eat it. Mm. Oh, God.
So is there any sort of, with your artistic head on, is there any kind of particular piece of, like, iconic picture that you have in your head that represents Greenham?
Because I think Monica's Goddess Giving Birth.
So was picture. That was a picture that she did.
It's in that big book of her, that very big book. There's a book of all her paintings. And that was her claiming the goddess, really.
And what's Monica's surname?
Monica Shue, S-J-O-O. It's a Scandinavian name.
And what's the painting called, the goddess?
Goddess giving birth to the world, something like that.
Was that something she did after Greenham or at Greenham?
Around that time. Right. I don't know when exactly she did that.
Right. And what is it about that that represents Greenham to you?
It's a very powerful woman figure. And I think it sort of says, it's about the importance of motherhood, really, I suppose, really, and giving birth and celebrating that, really. Mm. Yeah. Power of women to do that.
Mm. To make life.
Mm.
Mm. And if there was, if there were three things that you felt were the memories and the legacy that you would carry forward for future generations for Greenham, what would they be, do you think?
I don't know, there's something about the power of women, the power of women coming together and determination to make this thing stop. We were determined to make it stop, really determined. It was not going to go on our watch, you know. Definitely, that's what I felt like.
And was that political activism your motivation for going, or was it, right?
Oh, so yeah,
it was primarily the cruise missiles and not the fun and the women only and the belonging.
It was both.
Right.
If I'm honest, it was both.
Mm.
I didn't know that it would be fun, so I got down there.
Right. Yeah.
It was. And a lot of very intense, close relationships were formed, which I've still got.
Mm.
I mean, I still know women who I met there
now,
you know, which is wonderful.
Mm,
having known people that long.
Mm.
It's great. Lovely, I love it. I think that's one of the best things about getting older is having known some people.
Mm.
My friend Gabrielle, who I met at nursery school, is coming to visit next week.
Mm.
I love that. I think she knows me in and out. Bad, good, whatever.
Mm.
She knows me, you know.
Mm.
I love it. I think it's a wonderful thing.
And so the friends that you still have from Greenham, have you all kind of moved through that pattern that you described before in terms of, you know, the arc of your life from young to older? Have you moved through that arc in similar ways, do you think? So have you still got things in common? It's not just stuff from back then?
Some people have. Some of those people are still man-haters. Some of those people, women, I should say, are stuck on the whole what you ought to eat or not eat thing, and a bit moralistic for my taste, I have to say. As you've already gathered, I'm not really very consistent or... what's the word? Deep thinking about a lot of things. Not as deep thinking as I ought to be, probably. But I'm not. It's just not my nature, so I'm not. And some people are... I do find it difficult. Some people are still a bit strident. Yeah. I was, but I'm not anymore. Yeah. I'm not out to change the world or convince everyone I meet that women are the best thing in the world. It's not my focus anymore. Yeah. But some people are, I know, are still a bit like that, or very lefty, very anti-establishment, and they sort of rant. She's off on it again, you know what I mean? I think I've mellowed, let's put it like that. I'm much less extreme than I used to be. I feel like that was part of that youthful exuberance. And I'm a bit boring and an old fart these days, but that suits me fine.
Yeah, pass the baton to somebody else to do that, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. My daughter's just gone bloody vegan as well. She's sending me YouTube things all about, you know, how you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that.
Yeah, well, it's supposed to, you know, it's part of our environmental responsibility and all that sort of thing, isn't it? So,
I mean, it's logically, it makes sense.
Yeah,
of course
no,
it does.
I'm not.
But I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I am not keen on cereals and nuts as a diet. It just don't do it for me.
No, no, me neither. But, you know, I'm sure at some point we'll be forced to do something or the other, won't we?
Yeah, and cars.
Yeah.
Things like riding motorbikes and cars. I love riding and driving. And it's going to be weird when we can't do that anymore. Get in a car and drive fast. It's good fun.
Yeah, well, it would have made my life a lot more difficult coming up here, for instance, without a car. You know?
Yeah.
Would it take it? I'd have got God knows how.
Trains and buses and...
Yeah, it would have been a nightmare.
But maybe if we all had to give up our cars, they would sort it out. It's also partly... It's chicken and egg, isn't it?
It is. That's exactly what it is. Yeah, definitely.
So there are arguments for... But it's lazy, I know, but I sort of really think I've done my bit. I'm not trying to change the world anymore. I'm just trying to get by in it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do, very much. Yeah. No, yeah, I do. I really do. So is there anything else about Greenham that you would like to say? Anything that you haven't said that you wanted to talk about?
It was very empowering. Very empowering. It was great. I really thrived on that. I think it was a bit... Well, I know it was a bit troubling for my parents. They were afraid I was going to get put into prison and God knows what was going to happen to me. And at one point, my father even came up to this all-women, men, not allowed anywhere near women's community, and insisted on coming to see his granddaughter, which was very, very brave of him. And they all really liked him. It was great. So, yeah, it wasn't the end of the world. And I did grow up. And I did learn from it and change and continue to change. And I think life is all about being able to do that, being flexible enough to be able to adjust to what is, you know, what you can and can't do. And finding a way through.